and how different their cultures are. And to prove his point, Builder said, just look at the chapels on each of the Service Academy campuses. So, the chapel at West Point Military Academy, the historic training ground for the officers of the U.S. Army, stands on a bluff high above the Hudson River, dominating the skyline of the campus. The chapel was completed in 1910 in the Grand Gothic Revival style, built entirely out of somber gray granite. Tall, narrow windows, it has the brooding power of a medieval fortress, solid, plain-spoken, unmovable. Builder writes, "This is a quiet place for simple ceremonies with people who are close to each other and to the land that has brought them up." That's the Army, deeply patriotic, rooted in service to country. Then there's the chapel at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. It was built almost at the same time as its West Point counterpart, but it's much bigger, grander. It's in the style of American Beaux-Arts, with a massive dome based on the design of the military chapel at Les Invalides in Paris. The stained glass windows are enormous, letting the light shine into the ornate, detailed interior. That's very Navy. Arrogant, independent, secure in the global scale of its ambitions. I urge you, if you are close to your computer or your phone, to do a simple image search. Start with the Army Chapel, Gothic granite, then the Navy Chapel, gray bricks flourished with bronze and copper. And then compare those two to the Cadet Chapel at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. This is a chapel from another universe. It was finished in 1962, but if I told you that it was finished last month, you would say, wow, that's a futuristic building. The Air Force Chapel looks like someone lined up a squadron of fighter jets like dominoes, with their noses pointed towards the heavens. It looks ready to take flight with a magnificent, deafening whoosh. Inside the cathedral, there are more than 24,000 pieces of stained glass in 24 different colors, and at the front, a cross with cross beams that look like propellers. Outside, four fighter jets are jauntily parked, as if some pilots, on a whim, had dropped in for Sunday morning communion. The architect was a brilliant modernist out of Chicago named Walter Netsch. He was given the same creative freedom and limitless budget that the Air Force usually gives to the people who come up with stealth fighters.
Well, I came home with this tremendous feeling of how can I, in this modern age of technology, create something that will be as inspiring and aspiring as sharks.
That's Netsch in 1995, interviewed by the Art Institute of Chicago. What do you think it says about the Air Force that they would construct a cathedral out of aluminum and steel in the shape of an upright fighter jet in the middle of the Colorado Mesa? That's what Carl Builder asked in his book The Masks of War. And his conclusion was that this is a group of people who desperately want to differentiate themselves as much as possible from the older branches of military service, the Army and the Navy. And further, the Air Force is utterly uninterested in heritage and tradition. To the contrary, it wants to be modern.
In the meantime, I had gotten this idea here in Chicago, working with my engineer, of the tetrahedrons, compiling the tetrahedrons together.
Netsch designed the entire Air Force Academy around pyramid-shaped, 7-foot modules. Tetrahedrons! This is a service for people who want to start over, to wage war in new ways, who aren't studying the Peloponnesian Wars or the Battle of Trafalgar to ready themselves for today's battles. The Air Force is obsessed with tomorrow, and about how technology will prepare them for tomorrow. And what happens with Netsch's chapel after it's built? It has all kinds of structural problems. Of course it does. Like some brilliant bit of breakthrough computer code, it had to be debugged.
You get into technology, you sometimes get into trouble.
Well, to go back to even one of your projects, I have read that the chapel has problems with leaky windows and leaky roofs.
Oh, that's a wonderful
story. Sort of a constant problem.
That's kind of a wonderful story. What happened is that all of a sudden these leaks started. And Ed Petrazio and I and one other person would fly out to Colorado Springs and get in a little cheap motel and wait for the rains, and it would rain, and then we'd rush up to the chapel, and it's a big building, and try to find out, you know, where it was leaking inside, how's it coming from. I had to write a report, and I was so hurt about these leaks, I called it a report on water migration on the Air Force Academy chapel. And needless to say, I received a little humorous digs over my euphemism. But what we found out was that actually it was the fact that each of the tetrahedral groups would move in the wind. And it's very windy up there. And the building can receive wind from many planes. And it's long, so it could be doing one thing at one end, the other thing at the other end. And these joints where everything is connected is where all the glass goes through. So it was finally decided that what we should do is develop a big cover of plastic over the glass windows, you see, which eliminated many of the sources of the problem.
This is so Air Force. You build a 21st century chapel in the middle of the 20th century, and it's so far ahead of its time that you have to do an engineering workaround based on a reanalysis of meteorological patterns. My point is, where did this radical new mindset come from? It came from the Air Corps Tactical School, in that intellectual flurry between 1931 and 1941. In those seminar rooms and late-night arguments, the culture of the modern Air Force was born. They would take warfare into the air. They would leave every other service behind. And if you stand in the sanctuary of the Air Force Academy Chapel and stare up at the soaring aluminum ribs of the ceiling, you'll get it. As with all revolutionary groups, the Bomber Mafia has a defining legend, an origin story. And as with all legends, it may not be strictly accurate. But here's how the story goes. On St. Patrick's Day in 1936, in Pittsburgh, there was a flood. It was a devastating event. Pittsburgh is unusual in that it sits at the head of a major river, the Ohio, formed by the convergence of two other rivers, the Monongahela and the Allegheny. And that spring, the convergence of the rivers swelled in a massive flood. Airmen do not typically concern themselves with land-based disasters. Hurricanes, maybe. Thunderstorms. A flood is the kind of thing the Army worries about. But there was an odd fact about the fallout from the Pittsburgh flood that would end up having a dramatic influence on the revolution brewing down at Maxwell Field. It had to do with the fact that among the hundreds of buildings along the riverbanks destroyed by the rising waters was a factory belonging to a firm named Hamilton Standard. Hamilton Standard was the country's principal manufacturer of a spring used in making variable pitch propellers, which were basic equipment on most airplanes at the time. Because Hamilton Standard couldn't make variable pitch propeller springs, no one could make variable pitch propellers. And because no one could make variable pitch propellers, no one could make airplanes. The Pittsburgh flood brought the whole aeronautics industry of 1936 to a halt. For the want of a spring, the airplane business was lost. Down in Alabama, the Bomber Mafia looked at what happened to Hamilton Standard, and their eyes lit up. The member of the Bomber Mafia who spent the most time thinking about all this was Donald Wilson. And what happened in Pittsburgh made him realize something. War, in its classical definition, was the application of the full weight of military forces against the enemy until the enemy's political leadership surrenders. But Wilson thought, is that really necessary? If we just take out the propeller spring factory in Pittsburgh, we cripple their air force. And if we can find another dozen or so crucial targets just like that, choke points was the phrase he used, bombing could cripple the whole country. Wilson then devised one of the bomber mafia's most famous thought experiments. And remember, they could only do thought experiments. They didn't have any real bombers, or any real enemy, or any real resources. They were spitballing.
Now, when we began theorizing about this thing, we had no air intelligence of any possible enemy.
In the thought experiment, Wilson made the manufacturing hub of the Northeast the target.
Thereby, we had a thing, had a unit that possibly could be reached by an enemy. And in order to illustrate this concept, we assumed that an enemy would plant himself down in Canada and be within reach of this northeastern industrial area.
So the enemy in this thought experiment is in Canada. Let's say Toronto. Toronto is 340 miles from New York City as the crow flies, easily within the range of the planes the bomber mafia were dreaming about. What kind of damage could a fleet of bombers do coming down from Toronto on a single bombing run? In a two-day presentation in April of 1939 at the Tactical School, they try to figure that out.
Wait, so they have a kind of hypothetical scenario, and do they imagine that a group of well-equipped bombers could bring the United States, or at least New York City, to its knees in an event of any kind of conflict?
Absolutely.
I'm speaking with the historian Robert Pape, who wrote a book called Bombing to Win about the origins of many of the ideas taught at the Air Corps School.
The bombing that they're focusing on are, number one, the bridges. Number two, they have the bombing of the aqueducts. The bombing of the aqueducts is important because what they want to do is they want to cause massive thirst in the New York population. They basically want to create a situation where there's almost no potable water for the population to drink. And then number three, they target electric power. They're not really investigating the psychology of bombing. They're not investigating the sociology of bombing. They're not really even investigating the politics of the bombing. That is the implications of bombing would have for populations, societies, and for governments. What they're really doing is focusing on what the technology of the bombing of the time, what target sets it would allow the bombers to hit.
The lecture was given by a key bomber mafia associate, Muir Fairchild. Fairchild argues that the aqueducts are the most obvious targets. The aqueduct system serving New York City is 92 miles long. Then there's the power grid. Fairchild directs his students to a chart, the aerial bomb versus traction electric power in the New York City area. Quote, "We then see that 17 bombs, if dropped on the right spots, will not only take out practically all of the electrical power of the entire metropolitan area, but will prevent the distribution of outside power." 17 bombs! Conventional wisdom was that you would have to bomb the whole city, reduce it to rubble with wave upon wave of costly and dangerous bombing attacks. Fairchild's point was, why would you do that if you could use your intelligence and the magic of the Norden bombsight to disable a city with a single strike?
Are they really thinking of the Air Force in this teaching as the primary arm of the American military in this kind of conflict?
They're certainly thinking that the bomber alone or air power alone is going to win the war. And what they're thinking is that it's going to win the war, and it's going to win the war and prevent mass carnage like occurred in World War I, where the armies clashed together year after year after year, and millions of people died in the meat grinder of the trenches in World War I.
You can see why Donald Wilson only half-jokingly
said that if the army had known what was going on at Maxwell, they would have put all of the Bomber Mafia in jail, because these men were part of the army. But they were saying that the rest of the army was irrelevant, obsolete. You could have hundreds of thousands of troops massed along the U.S.-Canadian border, complete with artillery and tanks and every other weapon imaginable. But the bombers would just fly right over them, leapfrog all the conventional defenses, and cripple the enemy with a few carefully chosen airstrikes hundreds of miles beyond the front lines.
I think there's a fascination with American technology.
This is Tammy Biddle, a professor of national security at the U.S. Army War College.
I think there's a strong moral component to all of this, a desire to find a way to fight a war that is clean and that is not going to tarnish the American reputation as a moral nation and a nation of ideas and ideology and commitment to individual rights and respect for human beings.
The Bomber Mafia, despite its ominous name, was never very large. It was a dozen men at most, all living, more or less, in walking distance of each other on one of those quiet, shaded streets at Maxwell Field. Nor was the tactical school itself some massive facility. It was never a West Point, churning out generation after generation of Army officers. During its 20 years of operation, it produced just over 1,000 graduates. Had the Second World War never happened, it is entirely possible that the theories and dreams of this little group would have faded into history. But then Hitler attacked Poland.
September 1939. The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest and sets the stage for World War II.
Great Britain and France declared war on Germany. And by the summer of 1941, it was obvious to everyone that the United States would soon be at war as well. And if they were to go to war, it was obvious that they would need a strong air force. But what did a strong air force mean? How many planes did they need? To answer that question, the Army High Command in Washington turned in desperation to the only group of experts who they knew might have an answer, the instructors at the tactical school down at Maxwell Field in Alabama. So the Bomber Mafia went to Washington and produced an astonishing document that would serve as a template for everything the United States did in the air war against Japan and Germany. AWPD-1, Air War Plans Division 1, which laid out in exacting detail how many planes the United States would need, fighters, bombers, transport planes, how many pilots, how many tons of explosives, and the targets for all those bombs, chosen according to choke point theory. 50 electrical power plants, 47 transportation networks, 27 synthetic oil refineries, 18 aircraft assembly plants, 6 aluminum plants, and 6 sources of magnesium. And this astonishing set of projections was produced in just 9 days, start to finish. The kind of superhuman feat that is only possible if you have spent the previous 10 years in the seclusion of central Alabama, waiting for your chance. The Bomber Mafia was ready for war. Chapter 3. He was lacking in the bond of human sympathy.
I received a cable from a motorcycle, British motorcycle messenger drove up to my residence at Castle Coombe outside London, and the message that he delivered to me was from General Arnold, which when decoded said, "Meet me tomorrow morning in Casablanca."
Casablanca, in what was then French Morocco, was the site of a secret conference between Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. The war was just starting to turn in the Allies' favor, and the two leaders were meeting to plan what they hoped would be the final, victorious chapter. Both men brought their senior military brass. For Roosevelt, that included General Hap Arnold, who commanded all American air power. And now, midway through the conference, Arnold was sounding the alarm. Sending an urgent wire to his most important deputy, Commanding General Ira Aker, distinguished graduate of the Air Corps Tactical School at Maxwell Field in Montgomery, Alabama. Aker was a charter member of the Bomber Mafia, a true believer in daylight, high-altitude precision bombing, and the head of the 8th Air Force, the fleet of bombers charged with hitting all the targets outlined in the crucial war planning document, AWPD-1. Come to Casablanca, the message to Aker said, now.
Well, they had kept the Casablanca conference under such secrecy and wraps that I didn't even know what that meant. But I knew that I'd better comply. So I called General Anderson, who was the bomber commander, and I said, have one of your crews pick me up in the B-17 at Bovington at midnight tonight to fly me to Casablanca to arrive there shortly after daylight tomorrow morning.
Aker arrived and went straight to General Arnold's villa.
And General Arnold said, I have bad news for you, son. Our president has just agreed upon the urging of the prime minister that we discontinue our daylight bombing and you join the RAF in night bombing.
RAF, the Royal Air Force. The ideas that had so enthralled Aker and his classmates at Maxwell Field did not have quite the same effect on the other side of the Atlantic. The British were skeptical about precision bombing. The bomber mafia said that you break the will of your enemy by crippling them economically, by carefully and skillfully taking out the aqueducts and the propeller spring factories so that the enemy is incapable of going on. They believed that modern bombing technology allowed you to narrow the scope of war. The British disagreed. They thought that the advantage of having fleets of bombers was that you could broaden the scope of war. They called it area bombing, which was a euphemism for a bombing strategy where you didn't really aim at anything in particular. You just hit everything you could before flying home. It's not done in daylight, because if you aren't bombing at anything specific, why do you need to see anything? And area bombing was explicitly aimed at civilians. It said you should hit civilian neighborhoods and keep coming night after night in wave after wave until your enemy's cities are reduced to rubble. Then the will of the enemy is going to sink so low that they'll just give up. When the British wanted a better euphemism for what they were doing, they called it morale bombing. Bombing with the intention to destroy the homes and cities of your enemy and reduce your enemy's population to a state of despair. The British thought the American bomber mafia were crazy. Why were they taking all the risks of flying during the day against targets too hard to hit? The British were trying to win a war, and it seemed to them that the Americans were holding an undergraduate philosophy seminar. So at Casablanca, Churchill says to FDR, "Enough. You're doing it our way now." And in a panic, General Arnold summons his commander in Europe, Ira Aker, to tell him the bad news. Area bombing had won the day. But Ira Aker was a member of the bomber mafia. He wasn't about to give up so easily.
I said, General, that makes no sense at all. Our planes are not equipped for night bombing. Our crews are not trained in night bombing. We'll lose more crews coming back into this fog-shrouded island in the darkness, and we will attacking German targets in the daytime. If they're going to make this kind of a mistake, count me out. I won't play. Well, he said, I suspected that'd be your reaction. He said, I know the reasons you've outlined as well as you do. But he says, since you feel so strongly about it, I'll see if I can make a date for you to talk to the prime minister tomorrow morning.
Aker goes back to his quarters, stays up half the night drafting a response for Churchill. Everyone knows that Churchill won't read a document longer than a page, so the briefing has to be really brief and convincing.
So when I reported in, the OPM came down the stairway, her high glass windows, and the sun was shining through the orange groves. He came down resplendent in his Air Commodore's uniform. He had a penchant, which I knew of. When he was seeing a naval person, he wore his naval uniform, air, and so forth. Well, he said, General, your General Arnold tells me you are very unhappy about my request to your president that you discontinue your daylight bombing effort and join Marshal Harris and the RAF and the night effort. I said, yes, sir, I am. And I've set down here on a single page the reasons why I'm unhappy. And I have served long enough in England now to know that you will listen to both sides of any controversy before you make a decision. So he sat down on the couch and took up this piece of paper, called me to sit beside him, and he started reading. And he read like some aged persons, with his lips half audibly.
So what did Acre write? The most basic argument he could come up with.
I had said that if the British bombed by night and the Americans by day, bombing them thus around the clock will give the devils no rest.
When he got to that point of the memo, Churchill repeated the line to himself, as if he was trying to understand the logic. Then he turned to Acre.
He said, you have not convinced me now that you are right, but you have convinced me you should have a further opportunity to prove your case. So when I see your president at lunch today, I shall say to him that I withdraw my objection and my request that you join the RAF in night bombing, and I shall suggest that you be allowed to continue for a time.
The Americans got a reprieve by the skin of their teeth. Put yourself in the shoes of the bomber mafia at this moment. Ira Acre, Haywood Hansel, Harold George, Donald Wilson, all the others from the Air Corps Tactical School. They had been working side by side with their closest ally to defeat the Nazis. And yet their ally seems incapable of comprehending the conceptual advance they have made in waging war. When he first got to England, Acre lived at the home of his counterpart in the Royal Air Force, Arthur Harris, otherwise known as Bomber Harris. They would drive together every morning to Bomber Command headquarters at High Wycombe.
It's very odd. Ira Acre and Arthur Harris have doctrines of bombing that are 180 degrees out from one another, completely different.
This is Tammy Biddle, military historian at the Army War College.
And yet they become fast friends. They really genuinely like each other. And in fact, at one point, Harris tells Acre, you know, if anything happens to Jill and I, my wife and I, we'd like you to have Jackie. We'd like you to be her godfather. So it's quite the interesting relationship, but they are operating in completely different ways.
General Harris's steadfast belief in the power of morale bombing must have offended Acre, or at least baffled him. Because what had the British just been through? The Blitz. The Blitz was a textbook example of area bombing. On September 4th, 1940, Hitler had declared, "The hour will come when one of us will break, and it will not be the National Socialist Germany." And in the fall of 1940, he sent German bombers thundering across the skies above London, dropping 50,000 tons of high-explosive bombs and more than a million incendiary devices. Hitler believed that if the Nazis bombed the working-class neighborhoods of East London, they would break the will of the British population. And because the British believed the same theory, they were terrified the Blitz would cost them the war. The British government projected that between 3 and 4 million Londoners would flee the city. The authorities even took over a ring of psychiatric hospitals outside the city to handle what they expected to be a flood of panic and psychological casualties. But what actually happened? Not that much. The panic never came.
London raises her head, shakes the debris of the night from her hair, and takes stock of the damage done. London has been hurt during the night. The sign of a great fighter in the ring is, can he get up from the floor after being knocked down? London does this every morning.
The psychiatric hospitals were switched over to military use because no one showed up. Some women and children were evacuated to the countryside as the bombing started, but people, by and large, stayed in the city. And as the Blitz continued, as the German assaults grew heavier and heavier, the British authorities began to observe, to their astonishment, not just courage in the face of the bombing, but something closer to indifference.
Can you tell me about the air raids at first?
The Imperial War Museums later interviewed many survivors of the Blitz, including a woman named Elsie Elizabeth Foreman.
Well, we used to go in the shelter all the time, and then as they petered off a little bit, we got a bit blasé, I suppose you might say, and we stayed in bed some of the time. We still used to go dancing, but then they used to put up that there was an air raid on. If anybody wanted to leave, they could and all that. And the same at the pictures, if we went to the pictures, you know, as they was called in those days, we used to just sit there. We never used to move and go out or anything until the actual time when we were bombed out twice, I think. We weren't actually bombed out the first time, just the glass. And I don't know if you want funny incidents, but it was quite amusing to see one of my sisters. She came home and she was sweeping the glass from the front, you know, because all the windows came in, but she swept it into the curb. And my eldest sister came out and told... They had a terrific row in the middle of the... This was during an air raid. The all clear hadn't gone. And they had this terrific row because my sister had put my eldest sister's best high-heeled shoes on, which were very hard to get in those days, same as silk stockings were. Bombs were dropping all over the place, and there were these two having a row over a pair of shoes and sweeping the glass at the same time.
Does that sound like someone demoralized by bombing? It turns out that people were a lot tougher and resilient than anyone expected. And it also turns out that maybe if you bomb another country day in, day out, it doesn't make the people you're bombing give up and lose faith. Maybe it just makes them hate you, their enemy, even more. The area bombing advocates had this cleverly deceptive word they used to describe the effect of their bombing. Dehousing. As if you could destroy a house without disturbing its occupants. But if my house is gone, doesn't that make me more dependent on my government? Not more inclined to turn on my government?
And I think we've seen this over and over again in the history of bombing. We've seen the state, the target state, if we're talking about coercive bombing, long-range coercive bombing, the target state finds ways of absorbing the punishment if it's really determined to do so.
I mean, just listen to another interview with a Blitz survivor, Sylvia Joan Clark.
Did you think the Germans might win the war?
No. I never thought that. I am very proud to be English, and I thought they'll never beat us. Never. I've had a home, I've had a mother, I've had a father, and I've lost it. But I've made up my mind, nobody's going to get me down. I'm going to survive.
Once they had tallied up the damage, the British determined that more than 43,000 people had been killed and tens of thousands injured. More than 1 million buildings were damaged or destroyed, and it didn't work. Not on London, not on Londoners. It did not crack their morale. And yet, despite that lesson, just 2 years later, the Royal Air Force were proposing to do the exact same thing to the Germans. Ira Aker says that he and RAF General Harris, when they were living together, had discussions, though I'm guessing arguments would be a better term. They'd talk long into the night, and once Aker turned to Harris and made this exact point, quote, "I asked Harris if the bombing of London had affected the morale of the British. He said it made them work harder. But in the case of the Germans, however, he thought the reaction was different because they were of a different breed from the British." That's Harris's answer. Some chauvinistic nonsense about how the average German was made of weaker stuff than the average Englishman? To Aker and the rest of the bomber mafia, the British attitude made no sense. And it was only later that they came to understand why. The British had their own version of a bomber mafia, with an equally dogmatic set of views about how air power ought to be used. Actually, mafia is not quite right. More like a single bombing mafioso, a godfather. And his name was Frederick Lindemann.
See, Lindemann was by any odds, a very remarkable and a very strange man. He was a real heavyweight of personality.
In the decades after the Second World War, scholars on all sides tried to make sense of what the war had meant. And among them was a prominent British scientist named C.P. Snow. Snow had served in the British government during the war. He was a Cambridge Don, a successful novelist, and friends with everyone who was anyone in the British intellectual elite. And in 1960, he came to Harvard University to give a lecture, a big chunk of which was devoted to the story of one man, Frederick Lindemann. Snow believed he had played a hugely underappreciated role in the way the British chose to use their air power. If you wanted to understand the befuddling attitude the British had about bombing, Snow said, you had to understand Lindemann.
Lindemann was quite un-English. I always thought if you met him in middle age, you'd have thought he was the kind of Central European businessman that one used to meet in the more expensive hotels in Italy. I mean, he might have come from Dusseldorf. He was heavy-featured, pallid, always very correctly dressed. He spoke German at least as well as he did English, and indeed, under his English, there was a tone of German. If you could hear him at all, because he always mumbled in an extraordinarily constricted fashion.
Frederick Lindemann, later known as Lord Charwell, was born in Germany in 1886. His father was a wealthy German engineer. His mother was an American heiress. Lindemann was a physicist and got his PhD in Berlin just before the First World War, at a time when Germany was the center of the world in physics. Colleagues compared his mind to Isaac Newton's. He had an extraordinary memory for numbers. As a child, Frederick would read newspapers and recite back reams and reams of statistics from memory. He could demolish anyone in an argument. Lindemann spent a considerable amount of time with Albert Einstein. And once, at dinner, Einstein mentioned some mathematical proposition for which he'd never been able to come up with a proof. The next day, Lindemann casually mentioned that he had the answer. He'd figured it out in the bathtub. Everyone talked about Lindemann, and for a writer like Snow, the gossip was irresistible.
His passions were much bigger than life size, and they often reminded me more than anything I can think of the sort of inflated monomania of the passions in Balzac's novels. He'd have made a wonderful Balzacian character. And I said, he was a figure who made a novelist's fingers itch. He enjoyed none of the sensual pleasures. He was the most cranky of all vegetarians. He wasn't only a vegetarian, but he would only eat very minute fractions of what you might regard as a vegetarian diet. And he lived mainly on porcelain cheese, what the whites of eggs, the yolks being apparently too animal, olive oil and rice.
Lindemann was eccentric and brilliant, but his greatest claim to fame was that he was Winston Churchill's best friend. The two men had met each other in 1921 at a dinner arranged by the Duke and Duchess of Westminster. Churchill was an aristocrat, and Lindemann was really rich, so the two of them moved in the same circles, and they hit it off. As for Churchill, if you read some of the letters he wrote Lindemann, they are almost worshipful. The psychologist Daniel Wegener has this beautiful concept called transactive memory, which is the observation that we don't just store information in our minds or in specific places. We store memories and understanding in the minds of the people we love. You don't need to remember your child's emotional relationship to her teacher because you know your wife will. You don't have to remember how to work the remote because you know your daughter will. That's transactive memory. Little bits of ourselves reside in other people's minds. Wegener has this heartbreaking riff about what one member of a couple will often say when their partner dies, that some part of them died along with them. That, Wegener says, is literally true. When your partner dies, everything that you have stored in your partner's brain is gone.
Now, we are the masters of our fate. That the task which has been set us is not above our strength. That its pangs and toils are not beyond our endurance.
I haven't spent that much time on Winston Churchill, but his personality is important here. He's a man of the big picture, a visionary. He has a deep, intuitive understanding of human psychology and history, but he struggles with depression. He has mood swings. He's impulsive. He's a gambler. He has no head for figures. Throughout his life, he's always losing huge amounts of money on foolish investments. In 1935, Churchill spent the modern equivalent of $60,000 on alcohol in 1 year. Within a month of becoming prime minister, he was broke, literally broke. Here we have a man with very little common sense, no ability to handle numbers, no way to bring order to his life. And so who does he become best friends with? Someone disciplined, almost fanatically consistent, someone who ate the same three things every meal of every day, someone so naturally at home in the world of numbers that as a child he would read newspapers and recite back reams and reams of statistics from memory. Churchill stores all of the thinking that has to do with the quantitative world inside Lindemann's brain. And when Churchill becomes prime minister in 1940, just after the war breaks out, he takes Lindemann with him. Lindemann serves in Churchill's cabinet as a kind of gatekeeper to Churchill's mind. Lindemann goes with Churchill to conferences. He dines with him. Lindemann never drinks unless he's eating with Churchill, who's a big drinker. Then he drinks. He goes to Churchill's country house on the weekends. People spot them at 3 a.m., sitting by the fire, reading the newspaper together.
It was an absolutely true and very deep friendship. And both men paid some price for it. And when Lindemann was very much disliked by other of Churchill's intimate associates, Winston never budged. They tried to get rid of Lindemann, but Churchill wouldn't have it.
And one of the subjects on which Lindemann was most persuasive when it came to Churchill was bombing. Lindemann was a great believer in the idea that the surest way to break the will of the enemy was by bombing its cities indiscriminately. Now, did Lindemann have any evidence to support his idea? No. In fact, that was the whole point of C.P. Snow's lecture, to point out how this man of science, this brilliant intellectual, manufactured and distorted the facts to support his case.
No one had ever thought how these bomber forces were really to be used. It was just an act of faith. This was a way to fight a war. And I think it's fair to say that Lindemann was, with his usual extreme intensity, as committed to this faith as any man in England. Early in 1942, he was determined to put it into action.
In America, at the Air Corps Tactical School, the bomber mafia dreamt of a world where bombs were used with dazzling precision. Lindemann went out of his way to promote the opposite approach. And the only explanation Snow could come up with is personal. Lindemann was just a sadist. He found it satisfying to reduce the cities of the enemy to rubble.
About him there hung a kind of atmosphere of indefinable malaise. You felt that he didn't understand his own life well, and he wasn't very good at coping with the major things. I mean, he was venomous, he was harsh-tongued, he had a malicious, sadistic sense of humor, but nevertheless you felt that somehow he was lost.
One of Lindemann's biographers once wrote of him, "He would not shrink from using an argument which he knew to be wrong if by so doing he could tie up one of his professional opponents." And here's what a friend said of him. "He was lacking in the bond of human sympathy for every chance person who was not brought into a personal relationship with him." That's his friend writing. One time he's asked for a definition of morality, and he answers, "I define a moral action as one that brings advantage to my friends." Well, there you are. I define a moral bombing action as one that brings advantage to my friend Winston Churchill. So Lindemann writes Churchill one of his famous memos.
It was a paper suggesting that every resource in England should be used
to make bombers, to train bombing crews, to use all these bombers and bombing crews on the bombing of German working-class houses. It described in quantitative terms the results of a bombing offensive all out. You chose working-class houses because middle-class houses have too much space around them, and so the bombs get wasted. The calculation was that if you gave total effort, you could destroy half the working-class houses in all the big towns in Germany, that is, all the towns with populations over 50,000 within the period of 18 months. 50% of the houses, according to Lindemann, would no longer exist. Remember, of course, the inference is that a certain number of the people inside them would no longer exist.
So Lindemann convinced Churchill, and Churchill appointed as head of the British Bomber Command Arthur Harris, the man whose home Ira Aker stayed at when he first came to London. And Arthur Harris was a psychopath. I'm not using that word lightly. His own men called him Butcher Harris. In one of his first major statements upon taking the post, Harris quoted Hosea, one of the bleakest of the Old Testament prophets. This is from a British Paramount newsreel.
The Nazis entered this war under the rather childish delusion that they were going to bomb everybody else and nobody was going to bomb them. They sowed the wind, and now they are going to reap the whirlwind.
Shortly after taking over British bombing operations, Harris launched a massive attack on the city of Cologne, a night bombing, because, of course, they didn't particularly need to see their targets, did they? Harris sends 1,000 bombers at Cologne, and they drop their bombs everywhere. In the end, the RAF campaign destroyed 90% of central Cologne, 600 acres in all, more than 3,000 homes destroyed.
It may take a year, it may take two, but for the Nazis, the writing is on the wall. Let them look out for themselves. The cure is in their own hands. There are a lot of people who say that bombing can never win a war. Well, my answer to that is that it has never been tried yet, and we shall see.
Once, the story goes, Harris was stopped for speeding during the war. The policeman said, "You could kill innocent people driving like that." Harris replied, "Young man, it's my business to kill people." Years later, Harris was interviewed by the British Forces Broadcasting Service. It was 1977. He'd had more than 30 years to think about his actions by that point. But just listen to him talk about one of his most infamous missions, the time his bombers reduced the city of Dresden to rubble.
People are apt to say, "Oh, poor Dresden, a lovely city, solely engaged in producing beautiful little China shepherdesses with frilly skirts." But as a matter of fact, it was the last viable governing center of Germany. And also, it was virtually the last way through from north to south for German reserves moving in front of the Russian and our own army advances.
To ostensibly prevent the movement of troops through Dresden, Harris has his bombers take out 1,600 acres in the city's core and kill 25,000 civilians over the course of 3 days. Now, here's the crucial part.
How do you answer criticisms that you did bomb civilian populations and kill civilian populations rather than members of the armed forces?
What we were doing, we weren't aiming particularly at the civilian population. We were aiming at the production of everything that made it possible for the German armies to continue the war. That was the whole idea of the bombing offensive, including, as I say, the destruction of the facilities for building submarines and the armament industries throughout Germany, and the people who worked in them. They're all active soldiers, to my mind, people who work in in the production of munitions must expect to be treated as active soldiers. Otherwise, where do you draw the line?
They were all active soldiers to my mind. Children, mothers, the elderly, nurses in hospitals, pastors in churches. When you make the leap to say we will no longer try to aim at something specific, then you cross a line. Then you have to convince yourself that there is no difference between a soldier and children and mothers and nurses in a hospital. Do you start to understand the Bomber Mafia now? Their whole argument, their whole reason for being is that they didn't want to cross that line. They weren't just advancing a technological argument. They were advancing a moral argument. The most important fact about Carl Norden, the godfather of precision bombing, is not that he was a brilliant engineer or a hopeless eccentric, but that he was a devoted Christian.
You might wonder why, if he thought he was being in service to humanity, why he would develop sites to help people drop bombs. And the reason was because he was a true believer that by making bombing accuracy better, he could save lives.
The historian Stephen McFarlane.
He truly believed what the Army and Navy were telling him, and American Army and Navy, and that is that we're going to destroy machines of war, not the people of war. We're not going to do like World War I, where we slaughter millions of soldiers. We're not going to try to slaughter millions of civilians. We're only going to try to blow up factories and blow up machines of war. And he bought into that. That was part of his basic philosophy of life, his Christianity.
So, Commanding General Ira Aker, Bomber Mafia true believer. That midnight trip to Casablanca to save precision bombing was the most morally consequential act of his life. And when he came back to his airbase in England, he said, "We need a new plan for the war in Europe, one that will show the British that there is a better way to wage an air war." And who does he pick to think up that plan? Heywood Hansell, now General Hansell, one of the brightest of the young lights in the U.S. Army Air Forces. The same General Hansell who would one day abruptly lose his job to Curtis LeMay on the island of Guam. Chapter 4, The Truest of the True Believers. Heywood Hansell came from an aristocratic Southern military family. His great-great-great-grandfather, John W. Hansell, served in the American Revolution. His great-great-grandfather, William Young Hansell, was an army officer in the War of 1812. His great-grandfather was a general in the Confederate Army. His grandfather was a Confederate officer, and his father was an army surgeon who came to dinner in a white linen suit and a Panama hat. Hansell liked to carry a swagger stick, like the British army officers did. Everyone called him Possum, his childhood nickname. Hansell was slender and short, a skilled dancer, a poet, and an aficionado of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. His favorite book was Don Quixote. He put flying first, polo second, and family a distant third. Once early in his marriage, the story goes, he heard a baby cry and turned to his wife. "What in heaven's name is that?" "That's your son," she said. On his final combat mission as a pilot, a bombing run over Belgium, Hansell entertained his exhausted crew with a rendition of the popular music hall song, "The Man on the Flying Trapeze."
"Oh, he floats through the air with the greatest of ease, this daring young man on the flying trapeze. His actions are graceful, all girls he does please, and my love was stolen away."
Imagine this coming over the intercom of a B-17.
"This brave herring eater is off the trapeze. He's back playing fiddle, that old Russian cheese, and my love has flown back to me. Ha ha!"
As C.P. Snow would put it, Hansell is the kind of character to make a novelist's fingers itch. In wartime, combat units are obliged to inform the press of their accomplishments in order that the folks back home learn of the progress of the war. But military press releases tend to be loaded up with so many euphemisms and elaborations and aggressive improvements on the truth that if placed in any body of water, they would sink immediately to the bottom. By contrast, let me read to you from a press release from December of 1944, personally dictated by Hansel from his headquarters on Guam. He wrote, "We have not put all our bombs exactly where we wanted to put them, and therefore we are not by any means satisfied with what we have done so far. We are still in our early experimental stages. We have much to learn and many operational and technical problems to solve." In the history of military press releases, I doubt anyone has written something quite like that. "We have much to learn," but that's Hansel. Unflinchingly honest, a little naive, but fundamentally a romantic with all that implies. Once, while posted at Langley Field in Virginia, he passed by a young woman in the lobby of a hotel, Miss Dorothy Rogers of Waco, Texas. Hansel immediately took his own date home, returned to the hotel, and invited himself to join the young woman and her aunt for dinner. Dorothy Rogers found him tiresome. He found her delightful. She returned to Texas. He wrote her every day for the better part of a year. She returned two, maybe three of his letters. They were married in 1932. It stands to reason that Hansel's favorite book was Don Quixote. Don Quixote is the gallant knight distinguished above all else by his ceaseless, courageous crusade to revive chivalry. Don Quixote tilted at windmills, suffered endless deprivations, battled imaginary enemies. Don Quixote would have written a woman he barely knew hundreds of times, even as she all but ignored him. But Quixote is a strange choice for a military man, isn't it? The Don held to an ideal, but that ideal is never realized. It's based on an illusion. He thinks he is making the world a better place, but he actually isn't. Let me just read a passage from Don Quixote, which I'm sure that Heywood Hansel, in his long years of retirement after the humiliation of Guam, may well have read and winced in self-recognition. In short, he, Don Quixote, became so absorbed in his books that he spent his nights from sunset to sunrise and his days from dawn to dark poring over them. And what with little sleep and much reading, his brains got so dry that he lost his wits. His fancy grew full of what he used to read about in his books: enchantments, quarrels, battles, challenges, wounds, wooings, loves, agonies, and all sorts of impossible nonsense. And it so possessed his mind that the whole fabric of invention and fancy he read of was true, that to him, no history in the world had more reality in it. There's more than a little bit of Heywood Hansel in that. In 1931, as a young army lieutenant, Hansel was assigned to Maxwell Field, was appointed an instructor at the Air Corps Tactical School in 1935, and distinguished himself quickly as one of the sharpest minds in the entire school. And when Ira Aker was looking for someone to defend the doctrine of high-altitude, daylight, precision bombing against the skepticism of the British, there was no question who he would pick. That was a job for Heywood Hansel, the truest of the true believers.
Well, the selection of the targets themselves was a pretty complicated affair in an effort to gauge the effect of the destruction of a particular industry upon the war-making capacity of Germany.
Hansel needed to find a target the American bombers in England could easily reach and easily destroy. Something so critical to the Nazi war effort that the Germans would suffer if they lost it. And it had to be something specific. It wouldn't make sense to target, say, railway bridges over the Rhine, the central waterway of Germany. There are dozens and dozens of railway bridges over the Rhine, spread out over hundreds of miles. Trying to hit them all would be a logistical nightmare. Then Hensel heard about what happened after the Germans bombed a Rolls-Royce aircraft engine plant in the English city of Coventry. The attack was only partially successful, but it blew out the building's skylights, opening the factory floor to the elements.
There was rain, and thousands of trays of all bearings were rusted. Enough so that they couldn't be used, and engine production stopped at a time when it was desperately needed. It became quite apparent that the rotating machinery was extremely sensitive to the ball bearing industry.
Ball bearings. Hensel wonders whether ball bearings might be the Achilles heel of Germany. Now, why ball bearings specifically? Because they are at the heart of any mechanical device, tiny metal balls covered in grease and encased in a steel ring. Inside the axle of a bicycle, for example, there are perhaps a dozen ball bearings, acting like mini steel rollers that allow the bicycle wheel to turn freely. A good road bicycle can cost thousands of dollars and include some extraordinarily sophisticated space-age materials. But without $2 or $3 worth of quarter-inch diameter ball bearings, the bike won't work. It literally won't move. Same is true for the engine in your car or virtually any mechanical object that involves a rotating part. Ball bearings were a huge issue for Carl Norden when he was building his first prototypes. The bombsight was a mechanical computer made up of dozens of moving parts, each of which had to rotate precisely to the right position in order for the calculations of the bombsight to be accurate. So if he had ball bearings that were of unequal sizes or weren't completely smooth, the whole bombsight would be thrown off.
An interesting side story is Norden paid dozens of people to spend a day or two or three polishing a ball bearing.
The problem, Stephen McFarlane says, was that when the war started, Norden suddenly had to make thousands of bombsights, which meant he couldn't have his ball bearings hand-polished anymore.
So Barth, who was his partner, who was the production guy, he came up with a very interesting idea. He would come to a company and say, I want you to produce hundreds of thousands of ball bearings. And he then paid people to measure each ball bearing. And when they found a perfect ball bearing, or one that, you know, met tolerances, that would be the one that would go into the bomb site, and they might have to look through 50, 60, 100 other ball bearings, and they would throw them out.
Ball bearings were crucial to everything in warfare. So where was the German ball bearing industry located? It turns out that nearly all of it was concentrated in a medieval Bavarian town called Schweinfurt. Five separate factories,